Welcome to the Movies on the Brains podcast. My name is Brian C. Wood, and with me tonight is my co-host, as always,
Chad Metz.
Welcome to another weird, wild, and wacky week in the world of genre movie news. So, Chad, it was a relatively busy week in the world of genre movie news.
It was slow there for a while, and then, you know, stuff happened.
Stuff,
as it tends to do.
As is wont to do. But let's start off in a different place, an unusual place. A place that is very lovely, a city called Toronto, and a film festival, which marks the beginning of Oscar season.
It's TIFF.
Your thoughts, sir, on the reactions that have been coming out of the Toronto International Film Festival?
So this is where I tell you that I have no idea what's going on at TIFF. I just know TIFF is going on, and I have no idea about any of these movies.
Well, Chad, let me inform you of such glad tidings as have come out of this. You know, there is a movie that came out this summer. It was called Dunkirk. And there was also a movie that came out this summer called Transformers The Last Night. And Transformers The Last Night took up filming equipment to Winston Churchill's home and put swastikas on it. Mm-hmm. And Dunkirk was about a movie about an evacuation that was basically on Churchill's doorstep as soon as he took over as Prime Minister. So one of my two favorite directors currently working in Hollywood today, a guy named Joe Wright, took over directing duties he directed a film based off of one of Churchill's many novels entitled The Darkest Hour. This is in the same series of books in which Churchill also wrote there's another really popular, really profile, not Profiles in Courage, that's Kennedy. But anyway, he wrote a book that was very popular, and there was a series of books about World War II and about his time there during World War II, and this was in The Darkest Hour is one of them. So Joe Wright has decided to adapt that book into a movie, and what we get is something that is a lot greater than The King's Speech and is being talked about in glowing terms.
Is this the one with
Gary Oldman? Yeah. as crazy looking Churchill that looks like Churchill with really, really good makeup design?
I think I've seen a picture of him.
So that movie's getting really good reviews coming out of TIFF. No, it's not The Gathering Storm.
There's that other one. This is The Finest Hour. There's another one behind it, and it won't show me. Grand Alliance?
Nope.
Hinge of Fate?
Nope.
Closing the Ring?
Nope.
Triumph and Tragedy?
Triumph and Tragedy.
There you go.
Yeah, Triumph and Tragedy.
Of course it's the last one.
Yes. Triumph and Tragedy is the one that everybody reads and everybody remembers, but The Darkest Hour and their Finest Hour are really important books to that series. But I'm really glad because, you know, the last thing that Joe Wright did was a little film called Pan, which was near and dear to my heart.
That's right,
and which I enjoyed, but no one else saw. So there's that. Anna Karenina and Atonement were his two Oscar bait type films. One did really well. They both got nominations, but none of them had any real run. But this is getting really high praise all around coming out of TIFF, which is something that I'm really excited about. And of course, late this afternoon, the reviews hit for Shape of Water, Miguel del Toro's masterpiece of creature feature. And I saw the trailer for this before Valerian, and it looked really cool and really interesting and really fun. And it's a story about a woman who is a janitor / cleanup person at a secret government facility in 1950s America, and they are holding this creature that looks something like the creature from the Black Lagoon in a tank, in a holding tank, and the janitor lady is deaf, but she can understand, or I don't know if she's deaf. I think she's maybe mute. She has an affliction of some kind, and she finds a way and is able to communicate with the creature, whereas all the other scientists are not. and they develop a rapport and a relationship because she's, you know, in the facility late at night when no one else is around, and her and the monster can, her and the creature can interact, and it's got elements of the Cold War, it's got elements of the CIA, it's got real elements of Russia, it's got a Beauty and the Beast type quality to it with the relationship, and it's getting like all around across the board contender status coming out of TIFF for the Oscars. So,
alright. Yeah, I've heard about it. I don't think I've seen the trailer, but I knew pretty much all of that.
On the other side, George Clooney's Suburbicon not getting great reviews, mainly because while it is trying to point out the fact that, you know, white people can be racist and mean-spirited toward black people by minimalizing them and putting them into boxes, the film apparently minimalizes black people and does not even give their African-American characters names. So there's that.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's not gonna fly, George. All right.
No. So that's pretty much what we've heard coming out of TIFF, and the next thing we'll have is Telluride. And Venice is also just finishing up, and then we'll move on to Tribeca. And once we move out of Tribeca in AFI Fest, we will be in the thick of the Oscar season.
It's that time already.
It's that time where we actually have a very complex, interesting situation on our hands, simply because the body politic of the Academy has changed. Over 800 new members. And, you know, that's a radical shift. It's a radical dynamic change. And that's the reason why we're in a world now where, you know, Warner's is going to push Wonder Woman for Oscars, where Fox is going to push Apes for Oscars. Things that you ordinarily would not see a push for are getting a push this year. And Del Toro's movie, while maybe brilliant, I don't think would normally have gotten the time of day, you know, especially considering his last thing was Crimson Peak, which nobody went to see.
That's right.
So, but it'll be interesting to see how the race shapes up from here on out. But it's going to be interesting because of the makeup and the difference of the Academy. You know, we could be looking at some unusual films getting nominated, which might bring some interest in intrigue into the Academy in the races for, you know, younger viewers.
Yeah. I'm with that dynamic. I'm interested to see what we're going to get. But we got a ways to go before we get there. We got to see what the rest of these movies are that we're going to be talking about for Oscars. Yay.
Yeah. So, Chad, let's move on. Drew Goddard wrote a small film. Called I think he wrote and directed Cabin in the Woods, or did Josh? I know Josh worked on it. I didn't know if Josh directed Cabin in the Woods or if he wrote it.
He wrote it. I don't think he directed it.
I think they co-wrote it together.
Yeah,
and he directed it, and then he was supposed to go off and make a little movie called The Martian,
which he wrote,
and was ready to direct, and then Sony and Amy Pascal came to him and said, "You know what, Drew? We have this movie. We're going to put all our villains together and we're going to do a thing called the Sinister Six and we want you to do it for us." And Drew was like, "Well, you know, I just kind of committed to Marvel proper with Daredevil and I'm kind of going to go do this movie called The Martian, which is going to make me a lot of money. Okay, sure." And Drew went off to make a movie that never got made.
You know, this situation is the reason
Ridley Scott was allowed to make another Alien movie?
Yeah, Neil Blomkamp should be cursing Drew Goddard's name because it's his fault that his Alien movie isn't getting made. But we got Ridley Scott's Alien movie, which isn't making any money, so the franchise might be dead. But yeah, so Drew, I mean, his track record of stuff that I've seen is, I'm kind of encouraged when I hear his name. I mean, that the Sinister Six movie never got made, so there's nothing for me to judge him on that, but everything else.
I was really interested because I thought his name might come up for Spider-Man Homecoming. Because Sony already had the established working relationship, having distributed Cabin in the Woods and also having worked with him closely on developing a Sinister Six movie, and Marvel proper having Marvel Studios having worked with him through their television side with the Daredevil show running, I thought maybe we might be in a position where that might be a thing, but it didn't come to pass. So he got hired this week. He got work. Ryan Reynolds apparently has tapped him as the guy to help lead the X-Force movie. Your thoughts, sir, on the X-Force movie, which will come after Deadpool 2, will star Cable and Deadpool, probably Warhead, Negasonic Warhead, and some others who will be in Dynamo, and some others who will be introduced along the way.
Again, because of going off of what I know about Drew Goddard, I think this is a... I never would have thought of this choice, but I think it's a choice that can work. He does have a track record in comics, and the stuff that we've seen has been fairly good. I don't know how much he had to do in Amazing Spider-Man 2, but who knows what he would have done with Sinister Six. But he was a showrunner for that first season of Daredevil, or most of it, something like that. And I like The Martian a whole lot, so I think this is good news for Fox. And when it comes to their Deadpool corner of the X-Men universe, they seem to make all the right moves. So I have, like, it is so weird that I'm gonna say I have trust in Fox when we're gonna talk about stuff later, and I'm gonna be like, I don't trust them at all. So strictly when it comes to the Deadpool stuff, I trust the decisions they make. So I think Drew
will work looks out. Like, because there's a guy named Drew Goddard who is a guy by the name of Simon Kinberg, who is nowhere near the Deadpool side of this universe.
No, I think he still gets a credit.
Him and Laura Shula Donner still get credits on Deadpool.
Shula Donner can get all the credit she wants. I don't care, because I know
that Gambit movie is never getting made.
Yeah, that's never getting made. But I mean, she's one of those, like, I'll put my name on it, producer, and I do think she does some work, but when it comes down to the nuts and bolts of it, it's the other producers. And particularly when it comes to Deadpool, it's like, I get my name on this strictly because I was part of the X-Men franchise way back when. This has the X on it, I get the producer credit, and that's probably the end of her involvement.
Okay. I mean, I'm interested to see what he could potentially do with this, given what's going on in the world. And given, if you want to get a sense of the comedic tone, because, right, that's what everybody loves about Deadpool, that the guy from Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza Place was able to play Deadpool and play him so sarcastically and perfectly to what the character is in the comics. You marry that comedic sensibility with going and looking and watching Cabin in the Woods from 2012, going back and listening and reading the screenplay and reading the cadence that he develops in The Martian. He has a very specific comedic timing and a very specific comedic tone to his work that will fit perfectly in with the ironic, sarcastic, bombastic Deadpool universe. So I think this is if you're going to pick somebody to do a Deadpool Avengers movie, which is essentially what you're doing here, a Deadpool team-up, this is the right guy to do it.
Yeah. So yeah, we just have to wait and see. But again, I trust them. I would assume that this movie starts shooting next year, even though we're way ahead of that, because they never said it, but it just makes sense. They're announcing Drew this early.
All right. So, well, I mean, they've already got Deadpool 2 in the can, mm-hmm. and, New Mutants is in the can, and they're in the middle of filming Dark Phoenix, and X-Force would I guess be the next film up.
Yeah.
I mean, Goddard is currently prepping a small movie he's going to do before that, but I mean, I think thinking that you would shoot in 2019 for 2018 for a 2019 release.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
So,
especially since they're like cranking out three movies next year, you don't go from three to none. So, crank out three, you get at least a Deadpool movie, an X-Force movie, and
I don't know if DC's going from two to one.
Well, that's because DC has their own sort of problems, and they're, again, I don't want to talk about them. So, And I think, like, I can talk about them minimally this week and not a whole bunch of bad stuff. So I'm not going to say DC. I'm just going to say that with the way Fox is trying to crank things up, from then to go to 3-1 without any external issues, I don't think they'll... Well, 3-0. I don't think they'll do that. So I think X-Force is the move for 2019.
I would agree. So, Chad, let's move on. So staying at the House of Fox, there's a movie called X-Men Dark Phoenix. There is a woman named Jessica Chastain, who you can hear from this point forward. This podcast will now be known as the podcast that openly promotes Jessica Chastain for the adult Bev in It Part 2. Because that's totally a thing that should happen. She is on the press tour right now for Molly's Game, which is Aaron Sorkin's directorial debut, with her and Idris Elba, about an Olympic skier who was running a high-stakes poker game. And it is currently getting good reviews for it all the way around out of TIFF. And she's on the press tour for that. And when she's on the press tour for that, she gets asked questions about X-Men Dark Phoenix because, you know, her name has been floated out there for about the last 8 months to play
Lalandra.
Yes, correct. However, she corrected the record this week. Your thoughts on Jessica Chastain saying she's in the movie or is going to sign on or has signed on, but that's not the part she's playing.
So, I'm not going to land Blast X-Men right now. But...
Because there is a redundancy coming.
Yeah. But... I mean, they never officially said it. So, yeah, it's fans jumping on the boat that, you know, that...
No, it wasn't fans. It was the Hollywood Reporter. It was the trades. Like, she's signing on to play this character.
This is true. So, yeah, when the trades say it, and they kind of all say it, yeah, you kind of lean that way. So, but this is not the first time the trades would say something. Be like, yeah, they're doing it, but it's not for this. However, I think it's stupid that she's not going to be Lalandra, because if she's not Lalandra, it would make me think that there's not going to be a Lalandra in this movie. And since you've, like, going out of your way to say Avengers, X-Men are going to be cosmic, and they're going to do the Dark Phoenix story, the Shi'ar and particularly Lalandra are a big part in that. So, if Lalandra's not in this movie, I don't know what this movie is. And we've already had a Dark Phoenix movie where I didn't know what it is. And that one didn't turn out too great.
Written by the same guy.
Exactly. And that's where I'm going to stop, because I'll save my other lambasting for the next part, which kind of feeds into this. Because I don't know what this movie's going to be.
I think it's very weird that the trades would get something like this wrong. Like, straight up. Now, it could be a situation where they were relying on sources that were describing what the character was, and fanboys and comic nerds were like, this is the character that best fits that description.
Yeah.
But to my recollection, it was like, no, this is the character she is playing.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't understand why that would have changed.
There's no reason for it to have changed. It's like,
It's just a con, you know, a Benedict Cumberbatch con type situation where it's like, we want to save this reveal for the movie.
But
no one outside of comic book nerds knows who this is. Yeah, so
I don't think anybody, from the way I read it, and it sounded like somebody asked her, how does it feel to be playing Lalandra? She said, she basically said, I'm in the movie, but I'm not Lalandra. So, maybe somebody did ask her, are you playing Lalandra? And she said, no, I'm in the movie, I'm not playing Lalandra. But, I mean, when you're that definitive, yeah, I mean, I guess you can...
I don't know. Cumberbatch was pretty definitive about not being Khan.
But that's all part of JJ's, you know, secret box. I want to hold the surprise till the end. But like you said, nobody knows who the hell Lalandra is.
But JJ got talked into that by Kurtzman and them. And it was like, we don't have to do Khan the second movie, but we want to.
Yeah, but I mean, there's no surprise with her. Like,
no.
She shows up, Lalandra, while she looks like a regular woman, her hair is very specific. Even if you only know the X-Men from the cartoon, she shows up, she's wearing like a helmet. The helmet's basic shape to cover her head, her hair. So no matter how she shows up, the minute you see her, the minute you see her head, you know it's Lilandra. Unless they're going to completely deviate from that, which with this franchise, ain't no telling. But I don't see the reward for hiding her as being Lilandra this far out. Particularly if she just says, just I'm in the movie and I can't really say anything else about it. Even if they specifically ask her, how does it feel to be in the movie and play Lilandra? She's like, it feels good to be in the movie, but I can't really say anything else about it.
Yeah, there are Marvel people looking out who are going to take me down.
Yeah, and that's it. That's all she had to say. We see people do it all the time. So for her to go out of her way to say, I am not Lilandra, there's a whole bunch of red flags for me.
And that feeds into this news from Mr. Simon Kinberg. Mr. Kinberg saying that the great cosmic sci-fi X-Men in space movie is going to be grounded. Your thoughts, sir?
So, I'm gonna say this first to get my personal feelings out the way. I'm not a person that really likes space. I know that might surprise people since you hear me on here talking about Star Wars and all this stuff all the time. I don't really like when characters go to space. It's like...
It defies your logic.
That doesn't defy my logic. It's just like, I don't care. It's space. I don't really care. Like, I'm shocked that I love Guardians of the Galaxy as much as I do. Because they're just in space and I don't care about space. I just don't. And the X-Men and me have always been work better when they are grounded on Earth and you do the whole, you know, symbolism of racism and oppression of minorities and stuff. So that's my personal feelings about it. I much rather the X-Men stay on Earth and you never deal with space at all. If you never deal with space at all in these movies, I'd be fine. However, if you're going to make a Dark Phoenix movie, and you, from everything else you said, you're going to embrace the whole Dark Phoenix story. And that story is nothing but a big freaking space adventure. When you say that, and then you say, yeah, but we're going to make you ground. It's like, but then why are you doing this stupid movie? Why? Why call it Dark Phoenix? There's a million other X-Men stories. Do something else that keeps them grounded. If you want them grounded, you don't have to introduce the Phoenix. I know y'all got this itch up your butts to just do the Phoenix, but if you want to keep it grounded, she doesn't ever have to be the Phoenix. It never has to happen. You already tried it once, and you butchered it. I mean, I guess you kept it grounded. Now, what I think they're going to do is, instead of the X-Men going to space, which these X-Men going to space is a huge, huge leap for me. But instead of them, like, you know, going to the atmosphere or something, which is, I can believe that a little bit more, I think they're going to stay their ass right there in that mansion, and some aliens are going to show up and be like, we want her, and they're going to try to blow up the Earth. I think that's the cosmic you're going to get. You're going to get aliens that look like humans trying to get Jean, and insanity ensues. And at that point, any fan of the X-Men that likes all this stuff, I would be pissed. Pissed. And I think that's what you got in store for you. I'm sorry, X-Men fans. I think this is what you have looking you square in the face.
So, Chad, you're not of the opinion and the belief that by grounded, he just means, like, Jennifer Lawrence is going to be more human than she is blue.
You mean like she was in the last movie?
You don't think that by grounded, he means, like, they're just going to be weighted and, like, you know, they're going to be measured in their temperament and they're not going to be bombastic characters. Even if they're in space.
Have you watched any of his X-Men movies? Because they're as subdued as you can get. Except for, like, Wolverine. No. No. I think he means it exactly the way you're saying it. And I think he's playing them firmly on the ground. That's it. And, I mean, look, and if that's the case, I mean...
Didn't we already get a Dark Phoenix movie set on Earth?
Yes! Yes, we did! And it was butchered.
By the same guy.
As much as people like to praise him for all the work he's done with X-Men, they always like to omit that he was the one.
Well, they push that off on Ratner.
And they can, but the stuff that Brian Singer was going to do wasn't that far off of this, because it's all off of Kinberg's script. So, Kinberg, like, the common denominator in all these X-Men movies, And I haven't really liked the X-Men movie outside of Deadpool. I like Logan, but not as much as most people. It all starts from X3. And the comic nominated from there all the way to here is him. We've gotten rid of Singer. And the one time we really got rid of Singer was First Class. And I like that better than most of them. It's still not perfect, but...
It's a Matthew Vaughn X-Men movie.
Yeah. But... I don't understand why... Like, they've already butchered the Phoenix going forward in this next movie. Because, again, they just cannot actually do it right. Like, the whole point of the Phoenix Force in the comics is that it's not Jean. It's this space entity that takes over her. That gives her these extraordinary powers and causes her to wig out and try to kill worlds. They keep wanting to introduce it as an aspect of her mutant power, which it's not. But if you want to do that, fine. But set it up more than just have her flame on at the end of the damn movie. And now people are like, oh, so we're going to do this again. So this is what we're staring at. Her mutant power has manifested as a phoenix. And now the spacemen are going to show up and be like, she's too dang powerful. We got to get rid of her. Or if they do show up and be like, well, she is possessed by the Phoenix Force. Where did it come from? Because it just magically showed up in the end of Apocalypse and nobody knew it was like a thing. So
it was the only way to defeat the Apocalypse.
Yes. And so is it just that...
Who then at the end says that his work has been fulfilled because he has seen the ultimate destruction of the world and he sees it in Jean.
These spacemen are about to come down. This is about to be a stupid movie. I'm just letting y'all know that.
Hey, hey. There is no Roland Emmerich attached. There's no Dean Duvall attached. So it's not going to be as bad as Independence Day Resurgence.
I'll give you that. But, I mean, do we... That's like stepping off a broom on the floor. That's the low bar? That's what we're measuring against?
Yes.
That's not very good, then.
It's not... It'll be better than Mars Attacks.
Hey, hold on. I like Mars Attacks. You can't dog Mars Attacks. I will say Mars Attacks will be better than this.
It'll be interesting. I think they're rushing this way too quickly.
Oh yeah.
Way too quickly for what purpose? You have Deadpool making a whole bunch of money. Focus on your Deadpool corner of the universe and rebuild your X-Men movies instead of having to throw a whole bunch of movie money at Fassbender, McAvoy, Holt, and Lawrence to come back. And then to add them to this young cast, which is still there, and to do this epic storyline that you've been trying to do for... This very much is starting to remind me of Death of Superman. It's very much starting to remind me of an awesome comic run that gets large popularity amongst fans and general audiences. And so Warner's wanted to continuously try to put it on screen. They came close to Burton in Burton's movie. That fell apart. They tried to make Singer do it. Singer couldn't... alluded to it with the resurrection. Mm-hmm. But couldn't really do it. And then they did it fully, finally, in Dawn of Justice 20 years after they first wanted to do it. Like, that is what this Dark Phoenix thing is starting to feel like. It's like, okay, we tried it once. We botched it. We want to do it again. Mm-hmm. And this time we've got a younger actress and we've got steadier hands around it, so maybe we can figure it out. Not realizing that, you know, the same creative team is still kind of around.
Yeah. That is actually a very good analogy because, yeah, when you say X-Men stories to most people, they're going to say, oh, Dark Phoenix. And a lot of that has to do with a lot of people just know the cartoon, and the cartoon did it. And people really got into it from there. So they want to see it in the movies. And, I mean, that's fine if you want to do it, but just do it right. And it's one of those stories, much like The Death of Superman, much like Venom and Spider-Man 3. You can't just drop it in the movie. You actually build to it over several movies.
Chad, if I'm not mistaken, Avengers Infinity War will be the culmination of 21 films, correct?
Some insane number like that, yeah.
And Thanos showed up at the end of Avengers in 2012.
Right.
And he will make his supreme debut in an Avengers film in 2018.
6 years later, yep.
Yep. That's a lot of building.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's when you have a plan, and It's not an ironclad plan. You have a plan. You know where you want to go. And when things come along,
you're you make little mistakes, like, you know, dropping a second Infinity Gauntlet into Odin's the vault.
But that goes show you know you were going to get there, but you didn't know how. So you just like, you can do this Easter egg. But then later it comes like, oh, we need to do this way. So, yeah. So, but you have a general plan, so people are more forgiving when you have these little mistakes. But Fox is just like, nope.
We're going to pay the original cast, the second generation cast, a whole bunch of money with this third generation cast, and we're going to try to do what the first generation couldn't do right.
Yep. Also, since this movie is going to be in the 90s, that pretty much means that McAvoy and Fassbender are the age of Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen in the first X-Men movie. Good luck pulling that off.
Remember, though, Ben's in the river.
There's not enough. No, I mean, yes, there are Ben's in the river, but he's supposed to be this age and this point. As far as I know, Ben's in the river don't mean the years don't keep going straight. He's supposed to be this age when we get to the 90s. So make McAvoy, he's probably like within 5 years of me, look like he's my parents' age, which are in your 60s. Good luck. Have fun.
Well, I think that would have been a whole lot simpler when Singer was on the press tour for either The Days of Future Past or Apocalypse, if he would have just come out and said, we're not leading there anymore. Like, Days of Future Past altered everything. This timeline is new. It's different. We are not leading to the Mutant Registration Act of 2000, which no longer has to exist anymore because, you know, freaking Jennifer Lawrence stood on national television, held a gun just to Nixon's head.
Well, that would mean, you know, I think to be a director, you have to have a little bit of an ego. And I think,
as we will talk about later.
And I think Singer has just enough to be like, no, I want my first two movies to count. That third one, trash. Get it out of here. Anything I have something to do with, they can stay in there. But then by that admission, he needs to get rid of Apocalypse because it's garbage.
As universally agreed upon. So, Chad, let's move on to the House of DC. Minimal DC news this week, and actually it's positive news for a change.
Yeah.
So, Gavin O'Connor, writing and directing Suicide Squad 2. Did he back out, or did he stay?
Today he stayed, so, I mean, as of today, yeah, it's fine.
I heard that I thought there was another project that he was looking at, or was that the accountant guy?
No, Gavin O'Connor is the accountant guy.
Okay.
I didn't see that today, so we're going to go with, as of today, he's still
as of this moment.
Yeah. As we record this, this is what it is. And we're going to stick with that because, again, not very often that I get good DC news and only good DC news. And I still don't want to talk about them that much. So, yeah, Gavin O'Connor's going to do, he's going to write and direct Suicide Squad 2.
Which is on hold because of Will Smith's very busy schedule and Margot Robbie's very busy schedule.
Yeah, but it still seems like they're trying to shoot this next year. So he would have, I think they're trying to shoot late.
He'll have more than 6 weeks to prep his script.
I think he's trying to shoot around this time next year. So he's got, you know, like 6 months to write a script and then have them on set in like September, October. That's all well and good. I'm happy to hear.
And, of course, for the third or fourth time, it is official, finally, concrete, in evidence, hard proof, that Patty Jenkins is, in fact, back for Wonder Woman 2. And she has got a significant upfront and a considerable back-end deal.
Yes.
Your thoughts, sir, on paying the woman who has stabilized your cinematic universe?
Look, when you only have one universally loved movie, you get the people that made that movie to come back, and you do it at all costs. And it costs WB $1 million $1 million to get Patty to direct the first movie, and now that it's going to cost them her writing and directing fee is anywhere between $7 and $9 million, which
Is a sliver of a percentage of the $400+ million that the film has done domestically.
Yeah, it's around 818 or 20 million worldwide. Again, and I think it's the biggest, if it's not the biggest worldwide opening, is pushing up on it for WB, at least for DC properties. Yeah, you pay her that money. And on the back end, she's going to get a percentage of what the movie does. We don't know what those numbers are, but...
they are said to be considerable.
Yes, so, I mean, she can be making like... I would not be surprised if she pulls down at least $20 million when all is said and done. And she is worth it. Again, your most universally praised movie. And it was a cultural phenomenon over the summer. It was a whole movement for this movie. So yes, it's you do the smart thing and you bring her back no matter the cost. And WB did the smart thing, finally.
And they paid the woman.
They paid
her. Which they should have.
Which I think we've been having a hold up because they've been going through negotiations, so they finally got to a spot. And but she's been working on it the whole time, so
she knew she was going to take it. It was just a matter of how much of a reward she was going to get. Because remember, there's precedent for this with on the male side with Whedon. Whedon did the original Avengers for not a whole lot of money and a whole lot of back end. He got his money on Age of Ultron.
Yeah. Yes. And that's kind of how these things go. But I mean, so it makes sense. And it's only the right thing for them to do. This is WB being smart for once.
Indeed. So, Chad, let's move on to a galaxy far, far away. Ron Howard is living out a childhood dream. He is directing a Star Wars movie. And he is directing a Star Wars movie that is about young Han Solo. It still does not have a title. We're in September of 2017. For a movie that comes out in May of 2018, it does not have a trailer. It does not have a title. It does not have merchandise. So I just want to make the world aware of that. Just hammering that home.
Look, we can just put a moratorium on that right now. You're not getting any of that until December. You get a Han Solo trailer with Episode 8, we can just put that to bed right now.
Well, I mean, they're continuously having to... There are only so many ways that you can divert people's attention with a wave of the hand and a Jedi mind trick around fires that continue to burn.
I mean, you say that, but yet still, every time they do it, we're like, oh, look. So, I mean, I'm going to keep... It's like, hell, they worked for that. It worked again. Try it again. Oh, we just going to keep working this until it wears out. And, I mean, look, people will start itching again in like a few weeks. And guess what's going to happen? We're going to get a Last Jedi trailer. And people are like, oh! And it's going to be done. It's going to be done until we get to the theaters in December. And they're like, oh! And then we get the Han Solo trailer. Like, oh, I forgot all that stuff was happening. And this trailer looks good. I'm ready to see this movie. Mission accomplished. We have won. And that's what's going to happen.
And that is why Kathleen Kennedy will be the head of Disney in 2 years.
Yeah. You can knock all these troubles with Lucasfilm all you want. She keeps knocking out these billion-dollar movies. Count my receipts.
Yeah.
I have actual receipts. Shut up.
Because, Rogue One did make $1 billion.
Rogue One, she's been over Lucasfilm. There have been two movies that come out since she's been over Lucasfilm. Both of them made over $1 billion.
The third one's guaranteed to cross $1 billion.
That was making $1 billion. One of y'all talk to me when all of your movies have hit $1 billion. Huh? I don't hear nothing. That's right. Shut up.
All right. So let's talk about that young Han Solo movie. We reported on the Michael K. Williams news about the half-human, half-animal character that was in the movie. And he said he was not going to be able to come back for reshoots simply because, of his schedule. So... they made a quick phone call to Vision and said, gave him some money and said, here, come do some mocap for us. Your thoughts are on Paul Bettany joining the Star Wars universe as a potentially CGI character.
Now, before I actually talk to that, it wasn't until you just said all that I thought of this. So, currently, right now, they're shooting Avengers 4, which, you would naturally assume that Vision would be in. Now, granted,
unless his head's missing.
That's where I was going. So, I mean, I know that people have staggered schedules and dealing with all this stuff, and they're going to be doing like some shootings overseas early next year for Avengers 4. But just listening to all that put together is like, well, I want to call Paul Bettany because he's clearly not busy. Why is he not busy? Because Vision ain't about to have his head. we've been saying it. I just want to keep using it. This is more evidence for y'all that, you know, I love Vision, but just gonna have to love him by his head attached to his shoulders. Now, with all that said, so there's a part of me that's like, okay, so we had a black actor and swapped for a white actor, and I know there is minor uproar about that. I'm not upset about that, mostly because Michael K. Williams is gonna be, it sounds like it's pretty much gonna be mocap anyway, so you know you wouldn't go really see him. And two,
kind of like the big deal about Captain Phasma being a female stormtrooper,
and you never see her,
right?
Yeah. And two, and we're still not clear on this, but it sounds like that character has either been completely replaced and put in with another character that Paul Bettany will be portray, or Paul Bettany will now inhabit this character, but the character will not be this mocap creation. Mostly because
Have enough time to finish those effects.
Yeah, we're still stuck with this main release date, and visual effects ain't cheap, and they're time consuming, so they don't have enough time to do it. So it's easier for it to be a human character. I would think if they're going to, and the way Michael K. Williams has talked about this, I would think that he sounds like very receptive to coming back, and it sounds like Lucasfilm would have him back. So maybe they're like, okay, we have to take this character out here. Maybe we can put him somewhere else, and it'll be that original character somewhere else, and they can use him. And they've just replaced him with a character that will serve his purpose, but be a completely new character. But so saying all that, it's I'm fine with the casting. It's just, but this is all emblematic of the fact that I don't know. It boggles my mind that Han Solo is happening at all as it is right now. But it looks like it's going to happen. And again, like we just said, Kathleen Kennedy is like the billion-dollar kid. So they're going to put this movie out. It's got all, like, it's almost like we've watched the Titanic just like set ablaze and sitting in the middle of the sea. And like it's about to roll into like, you know, an oil tanker to spill too. And it's like about to like completely blow up. And we're watching it. But somehow, some way, it's going to go through the thing unscathed, and it's going to come out the other side completely pristine.
After like we've like, washed it like a bush on fire. That burns yet does not a burning bush that does not burn.
Yeah. I've seen a burning bush. That's funny. Yeah, like it. Well, except that we'll watch it burn and be like, it looks like it's burning. I mean, the branches are withering and everything, and then we turn our back and turn around, and it's just sitting there like, nope, I'm fine. Like I just had water. I'm fine. I'm fluffy. That's what this movie's gonna be like. It's gonna be like, this is the train wreckiest of all train wrecks, and it's like, how do you
salvage a good movie out of this?
Yeah, how'd y'all do it? I don't know, but y'all did it. Okay, fine.
Or it could be the death nail and therefore the first real stumbling block for them in their this iteration. Because if it doesn't work, that creates real, you know, questions about, you know, your other legacy characters and your other independent ideas.
So I mean, realistically, the outcome probably is a bit in the middle, is that we get, you know, an okay movie that we can see the seams, but it still makes good money, and
no one expected Rogue One to make $1 billion. No. We're all targeting somewhere around $850 million
for yeah, that. Yeah. So I think if it made that kind of money, I think that'll be, you know, okay for what this movie could be. But being just off the track record of Star Wars alone, I think it'll probably be closer to $1 billion. And people will be like, I mean, this was really supposed to be the one that, like, it wasn't going to blow you up, but it was going to ding you a little bit. And now you're just sitting there like, nope. And I think what will come out of all this, and we'll probably find out when we get that'll be an effect of what the next story is that Lucasfilm will refine the way they pick their talent, and they'll be like, we ain't going through this ever again, and I don't care if y'all don't like these old dusties, that's what y'all getting. Y'all getting these old dusties to make these movies, because they don't give me no problem. The rest of them do.
So, I mean, I think that the interesting thing to me will be to see the reaction to that first footage, what it looks like, and Lord and Miller's reaction to that first footage. Because I think that these people, I think, are going to be very active. They have not been passive. I mean, they got their side of this thing out there as quickly as possible. And we'll talk about this latest director change here in a second. That guy did not get his story out and made no effort to get his side of the story out. And is not refuting the information that is out there about him. So, I mean, I don't think they're going to be quiet as this thing is going on.
I don't think they will. Well, they don't have to be because, unlike some of the other people, they have more skins on the wall, so they can say stuff. But again, I mean, they can say stuff, but it's going to come down to them versus Lucasfilm, which is pretty much versus Kathleen Kennedy. And Kathleen Kennedy has a whole lot of skins on the wall and a whole lot of respect in that town.
Well, I mean, we've trod this ground a lot. But to me, with the young Han Solo movie itself, what is frustrating is you can pick up the phone and you know Frank Marshall. Like, you can call Frank Marshall and be like, what was that Jurassic World set like? Or, you know Amy Pascal. Like, I'm pretty sure Feige has her number. You could have called up Amy Pascal and been like, what was the working relationship like with y'all on the Jump Street movies? What was that set like? You could call Channing Tatum. Hey, Channing, what's it like to work with these guys? And you would have gotten a firm idea of what a Lord Miller set is run like. You know, it's one thing if you've got someone like Josh Trank, who's done one movie with a schizophrenic writer like Max Landis, and it turned out halfway decent and made money in January, and that's the only movie you've ever done. Yeah, it's hard to get a feel for what that guy's set presence is like, or how he marshals the troops, or how he runs his set. But when it's a guy who... When it's a set of directors who have done two live-action, well-financed, well-produced, well-received movies, and two animated movies that have been well-produced and well-received and made good money, that's a lot different because there are more bodies along the line, more people in the 6 degrees of separation that you can pick up the phone and call and find out information about them. You know, it's like, you know, there were articles this week about Notre Dame and the history of Notre Dame and all that with them having the game against Georgia this past weekend, going back to the national championship game and the Sugar Bowl against Herschel Walker and all that. People forget they hired a guy named George O'Leary who was their coach for like 5 days until they figured out that he had lied obtusely on his resume. Like, completely made up whole lines of his resume. How did that happen? At a prestigious college in a prestigious athletic department with qualified, capable people, how did it happen that they didn't check references? Same way here. How can you be so connected in Hollywood and know so many people and have so many 6 degrees of separation, yet not pick up the phone and call Pascal, call the head of animation distribution at whatever studio does the
Warner Brothers,
who does the Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs movies? Not picking up the phone and calling Channing Tatum or Jonah Hill or Ice Cube. Not picking up the phone and calling Anna Kendrick or whoever it is who plays the female in the Claudia with a Chance of Meatballs movies. Like, not picking up the phone and calling Chris Pratt. Not picking up and calling, you know, again, the head of Warner's distribution for the Lego movie. Like, make those phone calls. Find out what they're like. If you don't like what you hear, don't hire them. It's not about them being young. It's not about them being inexperienced. It was about two different philosophies of how to run a set. Okay, fine. Find that out by talking to people.
So, I think there's a deeper story into why they went with Lord and Miller. But if I'm just gonna.
Off the information that we know now.
Off the information we know now, it seems like this was a match made in hell from the jump. But I would think that she would have done her due diligence, like, This is how their set works. However, you know, that we want to try something new. They can run their set like this as long as they stick to the parameters of the story. And when they were going too far outside of those parameters and were like, well, you hired us to do this, and this is what we want to do now.
And we told you this is what we wanted to do.
And that's the thing. I don't think she would have hired them without getting together with them and talking about it and like, okay, this is y'all process. This is how you work. Fine. You can do this. But this is the story we want told, and we want it to be this story. And I think it would have came to the point where they were like, well, this is still the story you want told, but this is the way we want to do it. And she's looking at it like, this is not the story we want told, and we let you do what you wanted, but you had to stay within the confines of doing the story. And that's where the butting of the heads was, and that's where the two went separate ways. I do think from everything we've heard, like, their process drove her nuts from jump, but she was like, I'm gonna let them do it as long as they stick to the story. And I think if they would have stuck to what she thought the story was, maybe they could have rode through this.
Right, but there's also that little bit in there about Alden and Emmerich having to rat them out because, like, Kathleen wasn't looking at dailies and, like, had no idea what was going on that set.
Which, it speaks to two things. It was one that the process was really like, I cannot deal with their process, but I'm going to let them do what they want. I'm going to trust them, and having people around her to tell her if something was happening. And two, it does, in the event, like, she did have some trust in them, and when the people that she put with them were like, nah, this ain't the way you want it to go, like, the story is not the way you want it to go, and then she looked at it like, I let you little bastards do what you wanted, you couldn't even do this. And then that's when she had to come down and was like, no, go, leave, now. And I think it's some form of that happened.
And it'll be interesting to read that book at some point.
Man.
Which got another chapter this week as Safety Not Guaranteed and Jurassic World director Colin Trevorrow was ousted from Episode 9. Now, granted, these rumblings have been out there all summer, pretty much since the Book of Henry, which a lot of people have just passed this off on the failure critically and commercially of that movie. But these rumblings have been out there for a while, and if you want to go back to Carrie Fisher's death last December, Trevorrow was like, we aren't even anywhere close to a draft, so we'll figure it out when we get to actually writing this thing.
Yeah.
Which, okay, so the story on the street is that dude was a base level prick on Safety Not Guaranteed.
Yeah.
He was a base level prick on Safety Not Guaranteed.
Mm-hmm.
He talked to Steven and pitched Steven his idea for a new Jurassic Park 4, which had been around. The idea of a Jurassic Park 4 had been around forever, that Steven had wanted to do another one. He came to him with the concept of what if the park was actually, you know, fully operational in today's society with YouTube and Facebook and Instagram and videos and ADD attention span, what would that look like? And so Steven said, okay, yeah, this movie, Safety Not Guaranteed over here, looks like something I would do. Let's hire him and let's go with him for Jurassic World. For what would become Jurassic World. So apparently, because Spielberg hired him personally, he became the next level of prick.
Now, let me just say this. If Steven Spielberg hires me tomorrow to do anything, I'm telling all of y'all to kiss my ass. I don't care what it is. So I understand if I'm in this field and, like, the godfather of this field comes and says, I talk to him and is like, I like your idea. I'm going to let you do it. You goddamn right. I'm like, ain't none of y'all telling me nothing. So, I understand that. However, it's going to cause a problem. But, as we'll get to, but I understand it.
So there was base level prick on Safety Not Guaranteed. There was super prick on Jurassic World.
And I think super prick is putting a little bit mild.
Yeah. There was super prick on the Jurassic World set with Frank Marshall, and they got that movie done. And then he got hired at Lucasfilm, and he got handed a Star Wars movie. And not just a Star Wars movie, the trilogy ender for the new trilogy of Star Wars movies that was promised by Lucasfilm in the very first announcement of Disney buying Lucasfilm. It was like, we're putting out a new trilogy. So he got hired to do that. And apparently he went from super prick to like mega prick. And apparently Kathleen Kennedy doesn't put up with pricks.
No.
Especially ones with not a lot of skins on the wall.
No. Because, I mean, yes, Spielberg may have picked you to do Jurassic World.
And Spielberg and Kennedy have a long working history.
Exactly. So, like, yeah, Steven Spielberg is the godfather and stuff. And while Kathleen Kennedy, I know, respects everything he does, she can walk up to him and be like, Steven, shut up. Because she's been there with him through a lot of this stuff.
From the ground up.
From the ground up. So, you being chosen by Steven, a person that she can go up to and be like, you're full of shit, means nothing to her. So, that arrogant ego you have, it's not going to fit in the same room with her. Because he's like, I've been there, I've done that, and your ego is only because of him, and I can tell him where to get off. So you ain't nothing to me, because you only got three movies? No, not 93, two. You got two, and Impossible. And then Impossible came out, I was like, oh, and that's your third? Nah, bro. Calm down. So I think this was on the outs before Book of Henry got there, because I think his...
He had been working on it since August of 2015. Jurassic World was 2015, right?
It's 27, yes.
So it was August of 2015, 2 months after Jurassic World, he got hired to do Episode 9. Uh-huh. And he had been in... Well, he did Book of Henry, and it was kind of an Edgar Wright Marvel situation where, like, yeah, I've been contracted to work on this film since August of 15, but I really didn't start work on it officially until... later, because I had this other project I was doing.
Yeah, and I think a few months back, you know, we know about the bring somebody in to do a rewrite.
Well, we know about the death of Carrie Fisher, mm-hmm. And at that point, that was last December, they did not have a draft finished.
Yeah, but he was working on it. Apparently, he has a writing partner he works on all of his movies with. Yes. That came along for this
both
one.
All three of his movies.
Yeah, and somewhere early this year, that writing partner left this movie. And pretty much from everything I've heard, that's kind of like the signaling of the beginning of the end. Because when he left, I think Colin wanted to leave then, because apparently he was fired. And Colin was like, you know, I'm loyal to this dude, so maybe I should leave too. But then he decided to stay, but he wasn't getting anywhere on the script, and that's where they brought in the other guy to work on the script.
And, the cursed child guy.
Yeah, and,
Thorne, I think is his name. James Thorne, Jack Thorne, something like that,
yeah. And somewhere after that, they were just like, he's still mega prick. He's still mega prick. He can't come up with a story.
He's still being a prick, and he hasn't cracked the story yet.
Yeah.
And we've got to be shooting by February.
Yes. And the rewrites aren't going... I guess the rewrites weren't going well with him and the other guy. And then the icing on the cake... which I still think didn't have any like real legitimate impact, but perception wise, is the Book of Henry came out and ain't do so hot. So nothing is trending right for Colin. So yeah, Kathleen's like, there's the door. I guess let you out. And unlike the Lord Miller, he has Jurassic World, which is one of the highest grossing movies of all time.
And a hand in the sequel, Fallen Kingdom.
Yeah. Well, we don't know how that's going to do yet, but I mean, he can claim that.
Passed on directing that movie to do this, by the way.
Yeah.
Because certainly, if the Godfather had picked him to do the first one, he would have allowed him to come back for the second.
I mean, even if he didn't want him to come back, he's like, how much did he make? Fine, he's back. So, I mean, he can point to Jurassic World, but that's kind of all his, like, I mean, I like Safety Not Guaranteed, but Jurassic World's like all he can really point to. And that's not, perception-wise, that's not going to cut it. So, he can't be as vocal about whatever happened with Lucasfilm as Lord Miller. Because, one, I mean, at that point, he's kind of almost literally biting the hand that feeds him.
And not only that, everybody on those sets were, like, ready to come out and say, look, dude was a prick to us.
Yeah, we don't want
to do it. Probably was a prick to her, and that ain't going to work.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, other people he had worked with threw him under the bus immediately. So it's not like he had a bunch of friends who could rush to the trades and defend him immediately.
No, so, I mean, I think he's going to be, he's not going to be as vocal. Even though I would really like the ins and outs of that story, too. So, whoever writes this book is going to be writing this book on, you know, from
Disney all three.
Disney buying Lucasfilm probably to the end of 9. Because now we need a director for 9.
And I think both of our assumption is that they will back up the truck and offer Johnston to just work for 5 years straight on Star Wars movies.
Yeah, but apparently he's, like, today they were saying he was doing press for something, and it was like, he's basically said that they haven't come to me for 9, and I'm only focusing on 8 right now.
Which has locked pitcher, and I have to do press for.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's just saying, you know,
they've got to resolve this before they go on the press tour, because otherwise he will be asked every single moment of every single day, and not only that, you have to start filming by February.
Yep. And so I think I mean,
you could push it to May. Like, you could possibly start filming in May of 18. But, yeah, like,
I mean, the other ones, they've had like a year and a half,
right,
to shoot. So, and they've all been pretty much done like 3 or 4 months before the movie comes out. I don't think they want to even deal with that. So, yeah, I think Ryan is the easiest and safest choice. And we haven't even seen his movie, but all the rest of these movies are like Blazing Infernos, and Ryan is sitting there at the table like,
he's on the other side of the lake just looking over.
Yeah, he's just like, he's sipping his tea and like, everything cool over here. We've not heard nothing. We heard nothing bad about him, this movie. Apparently, like, they let him do his own thing, and
he played within the sandbox.
He played within the sandbox, but it's different. Like, this was from Slash Film. They're like, they've seen people that have seen it. It's like, this is a different Star Wars movie. But Lucasfilm is really, really happy with it. So, if you did that for this one, why don't mess up the train? Have a good thing going. Even though secretly, not even so secretly, I kind of want Spielberg to do it. Just because.
But Spielberg was approached about 7 and said, look, that's George's baby. That's not mine. That's George's baby. Yeah, and I would not tread on George's ground.
But it's about 5 years now. Maybe things have changed.
Well, I mean, he's got an Indiana Jones movie to make without Shia LaBeouf.
I mean, that's a Lucasfilm movie. They can, I think they'll be like, you know what? We can push that one a little bit further here.
No, I can't push that at all.
I understand.
Because you really Harrison's going to die.
Yeah, Harrison's up there. You can't really push too much, Steven. But if you really want to do Star Wars, who are we to tell you no? But I think it's going to be Ryan in the end.
I think it'll either be Ryan, and I think JJ's the fallback.
Apparently JJ and Kathleen butted heads too, but apparently that seems to be a theme with everybody.
Well,
we didn't really
hear any of that though.
No,
we heard that they were pressed for time, that they pussyfooted around for a year with Ardnett and Abrams and Cassidy working together and getting nowhere, and then Bob Iger was like, "Yo, dudes, I promised my shareholders Star Wars revenue in 2015, so." If you want me to do it, I'll push it back to the fourth quarter of 2015.
That's it.
But you got to have a movie out for 2015.
Yeah.
And then Abrams was apparently like, well, personally, I'd want this move to May of 16. But if you're not going to do that, you're going to make us have it out for December of 15. The only way that's going to happen is if we get rid of Ardnett, me and Kasdan work together, and we try and push something out as quickly as possible. Because we've got this cast already in place, and we've got these shooting dates already, and we've got to go. So that's the only way that can happen. And I think that was the only tension I ever heard with Kennedy and JJ was between JJ trying to say, push it back a full year. Like, let's not make it May of 15, let's make it May of 16. That'll give us some breathing room, and we can do this properly. And Kennedy was like, well, I don't know, maybe we could go 6 months and split the difference. And then Iger was like, I don't care, but it's either going to be May or December, because we ain't going to not have a Star Wars movie out for 15.
Yeah.
So that was the only time I ever heard of any kind of tension between those two, was like over when the release date was going to get pushed.
And maybe that's all the tension they had, but that could be enough.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting. It's not like J.J. has done anything since Force Awakens. I mean, he deserved a long vacation after working for 10 consecutive years.
Yeah, yeah, this is true. But I just don't see J.J. being the guy. He could, but...
You want somebody who you've worked with before, who knows your processes and knows how to do it.
Yeah. And ideally somebody that can do it well and not give you any headaches.
Right. And J.J. provided minimal headaches.
Yeah.
Less headaches than Josh Trank.
Yeah, that was a headache that didn't really get started.
Never really got started. All that. Now, you want to talk about a phone call Simon Kinberg made. Hey, Kathy. Kathy, you might want to know some things here.
Yeah, Star Wars has been good to me. So, yeah, Josh. Josh might not be the one.
No. So, Chad, moving on. There is a Marvel movie coming out in November. Some friends of ours, namely Jim Vavida, did a set visit almost exactly a year ago. That set visit, or pieces and parts of it anyway, landed on the internet this week. And so we've got a lot to process here, but let's start off with the timeline. Timeline's a very screwy thing. We all thought the Avengers occurred in 2012, but based off the math that we were given in Spider-Man Homecoming, it looks more like it happened in 2010.
Yep.
So, your thoughts, sir, on the information that Thor Ragnarok will take place at alongside or parallel to the events of Captain America: Civil War and Homecoming?
I mean, it's not the first time Marvel has done this. If you know the history of it, pretty much Iron Man 2, The Incredible Hulk, and the first
Nick
Thor.
Fury's whatever it was called, the comic.
Yeah, and it, all of those things pretty much happened at the same time. So this is Marvel going back to that. It's like, we've got this timeline, we've got a whole bunch of movies, timelines are getting a little bit screwy, so we're going to pile a bunch of these events that can conceivably happen at around the same time, and nobody will question it altogether. And with Thor, it can happen pretty much whenever they want, because it's not on Earth.
By the way, I'm assuming this Winterberm dude was like basically Feige's surrogate on the Sydney, Australia set.
Sounds like it. I think he's like one of the producers.
Since since Feige was on set in Atlanta doing Homecoming and couldn't be in Australia for the Thor filming.
Yeah, he's the one that told the reporters that he can't believe they were here on this particular day of filming, which they're... The day that they saw was...
The climax.
If you've seen the trailers, it appears to be the scene...
What god are you again?
Yeah, and Thor jumps back on with all the lightning, and you've also got that shot of Loki and Valkyrie and Hulk all there. It would be that scene. But they couldn't hear anything because, you know, paranoid and all.
But his comment was, things happen on top of each other now in Phase 3. They're not as interlocked as they were in Phase 1.
Which makes sense, because I think they're going to shoot for Phase 3 being... Well, the rest of these movies pretty much happening within a year of Civil War. So Civil War, Homecoming, and Thor all happening pretty much, let's say, the same month-ish. Black Panther's probably going to happen a few months. Black Panther's probably happening...
About the same time, because...
About the same time as Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Because, T'Challa's come back from dealing with Civil War.
And he's going to get crowned.
And he gets crowned. But I read it somewhere. It's not that far after Civil War
right. That
it happens. So all of this is probably happening within a 3-month span of Civil War, which took place in 2016.
I don't know by that math.
Because
we see the 6 years later card at the beginning of...
Of Homecoming.
Homecoming.
But if Avengers took place in 2010, then that would be 2016.
Okay.
So, I think, everything is happening in 2016. So, it'll be late 2016, early 2017 by the time we get to Infinity War. It all works, and they're pulling it all together because they can, and to make everything work out well. And it's fine. It doesn't change anything for anybody, really.
So Thor, since we last saw Thor abandoning Jane Foster again and going off into space without even a single phone call, Because he was hanging out with his Avengers buddies.
They do say that.
Yeah, I'm aware. We'll get to that. We'll get to that information later. But whenever he twirls his little hammer and goes off to search for the big purple guy, he basically becomes a man on a mission.
Mm-hmm.
Just basically becoming a Mad Max type figure, going from desperate place to desperate place, settling world-ending, universe-ending conflict after world-ending, universal conflict, and growing as an individual.
He goes on. I guess you summed it up right. He's like a man on a mission. He doesn't really go back to Asgard, because Asgard, which I don't know why. I mean, I know why he's going on this mission, but apparently Asgard is going through some things, which is how Hela gets loose in the first place. But yeah, he spent 2 years just wandering around trying to figure out
sleuthing. Detectiving, trying to put the pieces together about who is trying to gather these stones.
I mean, all of what you said is accurate. I would just not use the word sleuthing in Thor in the same sentence. I think he's just, you know, meandering around and fighting people, getting information is like, and in his Thor way, like, oh, so this is happening because of this. So, I mean, I guess this sleuthing is just when I hear sleuthing, I think of Batman and Sherlock Holmes, and Thor ain't done.
Well, Selvig is.
But it doesn't seem like he's going back to Earth. He could be.
He
goes back because of
Crazy Hobo.
Yeah, but I don't think he makes frequent trips back to Earth. He's probably has some dealing with Earth because he has to deal with, you know, your favorite subject of Jane Foster. But I don't think he's done anything outside of that. So it's pretty much Thor on his own going across the universe trying to figure out the mystery of the Infinity Gems.
So, Chad, let me take you back to that theater and the grand slate announcement of Phase 3. Do you recall what Kevin Feige, producer and head of Marvel Studios, said at that presentation when he talked about Thor Ragnarok?
I don't remember what he said.
It is on YouTube. If you would like to go back and watch the full presentation, it is on YouTube. But what he said was, Thor Ragnarok is as vital to Phase 3 as Winter Soldier is to Phase 2. So, we all wondered if that still held true all these years later, because that was a long time ago when he said that.
Yes.
And it's gone through a lot of changes since then. Some more changes we learned about today with how Watiti molded it in his image. But, your thoughts, sir, on the fact that the turning point, the Winter Soldier of Phase 3, will be Thor Ragnarok.
Looking at these comments and hearing you say that, that makes more sense. Because in Winter Soldier, the turning point was the destruction of S.H.I.E.L.D.
You destroyed S.H.I.E.L.D., yeah.
And from these comments, it seems like Ragnarok is going to destroy Asgard, which in these comments makes Asgard come off as like the protector of the universe. The ones that's kind of keeping all this bad stuff in check.
In Phase 1, we established this cosmology that involved Asgard, Odin, and certain ideas that you thought were eternal and could never change. Ragnarok breaks them down in a very similar way to how Winter Soldier broke down S.H.I.E.L.D. The effects of this breakdown will extend far beyond Thor Ragnarok, right into the next two Avengers films. With these galactic protective pieces off the chessboard, everything's going to be 10 times harder for our Marvel heroes when they do finally face off against Thanos.
I never thought of Asgard in that light.
He kind of talks about that around the campfire with Jane in the first one.
He does.
About like how there are the nine realms and Asgard's the center of the nine realms and what you call magic, I call science, and really they're a blend of the two.
Yeah. And, I mean, we've seen them pop up here and there, so I guess it was then to be true. We just haven't, like, really seen it. So I think we'll get more of a feel of it in this movie and then see it get thrown apart. And then where that goes from there is going to be interesting. But hearing them say, you know, you'll directly feel it in the next two Avengers movies, I think it plays into one of our theories, particularly in these comments that they talk about how Hela is pretty much the reason that that Asgard comes down. And we've been theorizing that, you know, Hela is the goddess of death, and Thanos has a thing for death, that Hela would be this version of death. And I think having her be in the next two movies would be that through line that we need, that they're talking about in these comics.
It would be possible. So let's move on to some other information that we gathered from the set visit. So we talked about the fact that it takes place about 2 years after the events of Age of Ultron and about the same time as Civil War. This line here about the film cold opening with Thor held captive by Sitar.
Surtur.
I thought we saw that shot in the trailer. The last shot of Hulk jumping up and going into him and punching him.
That is Surtur, yes.
So, if he's being held captive and he doesn't meet Thor until he ends up on Sakaar...
Yeah, I think we go back to wherever Surtur is. Mostly because of that trailer, we saw that Hulk did it, and Thor doesn't meet Hulk until he's got his head shaven and is taken to Sakaar. However, we know that Hulk is going to meet Surtur because we see it in the trailer, and
we've seen the pop vinyl of him as part of the Thor Ragnarok line.
Yeah, and there's another toy that with Thor that has Surtur's implications that I won't say because it's like kind of really spoilery. So. Yeah, they're going to go back to Surtur. I'm more than sure of that. It's just interesting that we're going to start off with Surtur and then have to go back to Surtur. And I don't know how that really ties into everything.
Hell.
Well.
Fire, lava.
Yeah, I just didn't think they would. I guess so, yeah. I guess you would break. Maybe that's like part of her last battle thing. I don't know.
So, the next little bit here. Loki is, Thor then travels back to Asgard, where Loki, now ruling under the guise of Odin, has brought the realm to the brink of ruin. Imagine how that would happen.
Yeah.
In this disarray and chaos, it has allowed Asgard to become vulnerable to Helena, the goddess of death, who has been waiting patiently for an opportunity to destroy the realm once and for all. From there, it skips around from planet to planet, becoming a buddy cop road trip movie. In which Doctor Strange shows up, and you have the Sakaar stuff, and then, there's a whole bunch of other things that happen.
Yeah. And that just kind of ties in, that pair kind of just ties in everything we already know about the movie. You know Doctor Strange's in it, you know Thor's going to go back to Earth, you know Hela's going to be the reason all the stuff goes loose.
We have to know where Helena comes from, because Helena could have been trapped by Odin centuries ago. And
I think she was.
In something, and then she gets broken loose.
Yeah, I think because of Loki's neglectful reign, which we can assume that, Loki's not a very good ruler, that this would happen. It just ties. It gives us the meat of what the story's going to be about, but not giving us the specifics of everything.
We're also going to go Game of Thrones here. We're going to get the nitty-gritty, dirty parts of Asgard. The Asgard projects, which still look like penthouses.
It's the realm of God, so you would assume that even the worst parts still look pretty good. But we've only been up in the throne room dealing with Thor and stuff, so now we get to see what the common people of Asgard look like. And it's still, while it might be dirty to Thor standards, it still looks pretty good.
Slums of Asgard, houses are slightly worn, paint fading with mismatched stones, benches are rusted, couple burn marks on the ground, but overall still looks pretty happy.
Yeah. So, I don't know what the visual look like on screen, but, to see if we'll be able to, like, really tell the steep difference.
Well, the more interesting part to me is the last part. Helena travels to the quote-unquote poor or slummy areas of Asgard to corrupt and weaken the realm from the outside. I'm going to foment a coup against Loki by telling the people who are poor and destitute that the reason they are poor and destitute is because that guy's in charge.
Yeah.
And I'm going to cause the poor and the destitute to come to the palace with pitchforks and torches. And allow myself to have a distraction to, do very bad things.
Yeah.
Doesn't have any parallels to history at all.
No, not at all.
So, So the Windburn guy, again, talked about Sakaar. You know, everybody pretty excited about the fact that all that rumbling and chatter we heard 3 years ago about them doing Planet Hulk or a version of Planet Hulk in this movie are fully realized. Your thoughts, sir, on... Sakaar is basically a dumping ground for the waste of the universe.
The only thing I wonder about with that is that, you know, that they pretty much said that this is a dumping ground. This is how the Hulk gets there. He gets... They're like a bunch of wormholes and just kind of dump stuff in there. And Hulk happened to get into one of those.
When he was flying around his Quinjet Joss Whedon would not be allowed to say was in space.
Yeah, I just want to see if they're going to, how far they're going to go into the explanation of, yeah, the Quinjet went in space, and how far this wormhole is from Earth for Hulk to make it to Sakaar. That's really my only, like, question about this part of the whole thing. But
there was going to have to be something along those lines to have intergalactic travel.
I mean,
black hole, wormhole, it would have been some kind of.
If I had to imagine there, it'll just be a thing like, you know, Banner as Hulk was just like, forget it, I'm gonna end it. I go into space, and he just ends up drifting off. And
a version of the comics where he goes up to Antarctica to try and shoot himself, and then he doesn't work, and he stumbles upon Captain America's frozen body.
Yeah, that's a deleted scene in Incredible Hulk. Yeah, I've seen that one. But yeah, I think that's where we're going to end up, and I don't think they're going to give us too much specifics about it.
All right, so let's talk about that Grandmaster who had yet to film his scenes when they did the set visit. You know, basically, he has created a very violent and hedonistic culture. You know, and there's also kind of a seize the day aspect because, you know, a giant asteroid could come through one of those wormholes and destroy them all. Sounds very much like ancient Rome.
Yeah, and I think that's the feel we're supposed to get here. And it sounds like he's going to be fun, yet kind of aloof, because apparently he can be...
Full Goldblum in his Goldblumminess.
But it's like he can be... They specifically say he's like a brutal dictator, but he doesn't like really... He's not aware that he is. So it sounds like he's just running the games, and whatever happens, happens, and nothing else really matters.
Yeah, he's just trying to make the people happy. And especially trying to keep the Hulk happy.
Yeah, because Hulk is his star attraction. And Hulk is, ever since Hulk has landed there, he's just been the Hulk. So that's all they know him as. And he is their champion, their gladiator, and...
Hulk pinatas!
Yeah, to keep Hulk feeling wanted, he always makes a show of it, like with the Hulk pinatas in the street, and... posted the memorabilia to show that people actually love the Hulk.
So even in space, they're hawking Hulk merchandise.
But that's different for the Hulk here, because, you know, before he spent a whole bunch of time running away from people. Now they're like, we want to buy stuff with your face on it. So
They don't fear him.
Yeah, and since Hulk is the equivalent of a 2-year-old, that kind of attention and adoration for a 2-year-old is probably a little intoxicating, and probably in the sense that he doesn't know what to do with it, which will probably manifest itself in bad ways.
Be interesting.
Yeah.
Be interesting to see the smoldering fire and the raging fire.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's move on. As I said earlier in the podcast, the elements, the Planet Hulk conversation have been going on pretty much from the time this movie started development. And we learned that they really were looking at this as, like, looking to the Planet Hulk storyline for, like, some inspiration for just, like, the general aesthetic. And then somebody was like, yo, you know, we could actually put Hulk in this thing, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's all we get Planet Hulk. I don't think we ever would have got it.
Well, I mean, we had that bit, remember, on the press tour for Age of Ultron, where he made news, Ruffalo made news about, like, well, you know, technically Marvel still has the rights to the character, but Universal has the distribution rights, so a deal between Disney and Universal along the same lines as the deal that Universal and as the same lines that Paramount and Disney came to that allowed Paramount to finish distributing Phase 1 and make all the profits off of it. That's the same kind of deal that would have to happen in order for there to be another standalone Hulk movie, because, you know, Universal would make all the money off of it. So if that's the case, I could very easily see why Disney wouldn't want to make that kind of a deal again.
Yeah.
So that's why I don't think we're going to get another Planet Hulk, another standalone Hulk movie, which would eliminate Planet Hulk as a possibility for a standalone Hulk movie. So if you want to do it, you know, you have to find ways to retcon it into the MCU, and this is pretty much the easiest way to do it.
Yeah.
There were some interesting thoughts about, you know, the processes of how you bring Hulk to life and, you know, doing a mocap character and eye levels and puppets and using multiple people, which was kind of cool and interesting to find out.
Yeah, you know, they said there's, they have three things set up on the stage. There's the guy with the stick on his, like a ball on a stick, so people have eye level. Then there's the makeup of like the Hulk's head, and then there's what they call Green Steve that actually does all the motions, so they can get that in the computer, and it's just interesting to see how much work goes into making.
Well, Green Steve Hulk basically just takes the place of Sean Gunn
when he does rocking and stuff. Yeah.
And it's a similar type process, eye level. You know, they have the eye level there. He squats down the entire time.
Yeah.
He's in the green suit. He does the motion capture for the character. And Cooper does the voice. It's the same type deal here, although Ruffalo will do all the mocap himself for Hulk.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, he's not named actually Steve. He's just, you know.
This is the third guy, and the first guy was Steve. So they just kept the name Green Steve, even though this guy's name is Jordan, apparently.
Yeah. And, you know, it's Green Steve Mach 3. So let's move on. So as we said, they talked to Kate Blanchett, but her review is embargoed for a little while. Why, I would have no idea, except just you want to drive up more drum beats for the movie.
I guess.
Because there's nothing earth-shattering she could say that would spoil the movie in a set visit.
Yeah.
See, the thing I miss about these set visits is, like, when Steve used to do them, Frosty used to do them, he would take his iPhone, or Chip would, they would go on these set visits, they'd take the iPhone, they would record the pool, what I call the pool interview, which is what you're getting here. You're getting, in between takes, Hemsworth is talking to a pool of reporters answering questions. And I like that, because you can hear more of the tone and the inflection of the answers and give you a better idea of an understanding than just blank words on a screen.
Yeah.
On a page, so. Her stunt double for Thor Ragnarok was Zoe Bell, who is a Tarantino favorite.
Yeah, I don't know who she is, but they thought it was interesting to tell, so hey.
She was on set, she did the mocap dots, and they decided not to do the big headgear because it was too impractical.
Yeah.
Which makes a whole lot of sense. You don't want that national treasure tipping over and, like, breaking your neck.
Right, yeah.
And that they use a lot of different technologies to bring the suits to life, which I think is really interesting and cool.
Mm-hmm.
That it won't be just a full, you know, digital costume. There will be some practical aspects there. And you learn a little bit here about mocap and how mocap works, which is fascinating. We will get the Warriors 3 in Thor Ragnarok, which will be interesting to have Sif and Valkyrie.
Yeah, I think that Sif ought to know that ship has sailed, so it'll be interesting if they even address it.
Shown back up on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. in the last year and a half?
Nah, she's only on the first season.
Yeah. Alright. And then, according to the producer again, Thor's arc in the movie is, quote, "The idea of worthiness, what makes somebody worthy, what helps someone find self-worth, is at the core of Thor as a character. That theme remains central in this film. However, in the first film where he was a petulant prince who had to learn humility, in this one He wants to become a better man and learn to accept himself as a leader, as a king, and someone who can lead Asgard.
That's good. I mean, the first one was about him basically growing up. The second one, you know, it's kind of there. So this one is all about him
coming to terms with adulthood.
Yeah. And that's fitting for Thor, especially where we start off finding him in these movies.
In 7 appearances later.
Yeah.
There should be some maturity, some character development and growth over the course of 3 solo films and 3 and 4 Avengers films.
Yeah.
So, and we also they also got a chance to talk to Hiddleston about Loki and his portrayal of Loki, which he was honored to come back and do, and he was happy. And he's really excited about getting to work with Hemsworth in the development. He felt like they got even more development than they did in Dark World, which, I mean, if you go back, again, when we talk about the giant book of the MCU that has to be written, a lot of the news coming out of Thor Ragnarok was like, A, there was a lot of back and forth between Alan Taylor and Marvel, mm-hmm. and B, they went back in, did test screenings, they got killed because there wasn't enough Loki in there, and they infused all the Tom Hiddleston they could get into that thing.
Yeah.
And some of the strongest aspects of Thor the Dark World are, you know,
with Loki. Yeah.
With Loki. So, I mean, it makes sense. And his statement about Helena is that everybody underestimates her and doesn't really truly understand her or her power set, and it just is kind of takes everybody aback.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, classic Marvel. Underestimate your villain, and hopefully they overplay that.
Yeah. And, yeah, hopefully they actually do something with her so we can have
Kate Blanchett in the Marvel Cinematic Universe for more than one movie?
Yep. Yes, sir.
Well, here's the thing. Where we know we have seen footage, or people have seen footage of Avengers Infinity War. What is the first thing we see in that Avengers Infinity War footage?
It would be Thor.
Floating through space.
Yeah.
Running into the Milano.
Mm-hmm.
A few years after the events of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Yeah.
What would that seem to tell you about the end of Thor Ragnarok?
Oh, things don't go well for Thor.
Yeah.
And if things don't go well for Thor, I think they go
pretty good well for Helena. Yeah. Helena. Yeah. Helena. Yeah. We also got some news that that we had already had confirmed to us that, very sadly, Natalie Portman would not be in Thor Ragnarok. She gave an interview when she was on the press tour for her last movie, saying that as far as she knew, she was done with her Marvel contractual agreements. And they are going, because the last time we saw Thor in a solo movie, him and Natalie Portman were embracing and kissing with a crazy little mud dog floating around the roofs of London, they're going to poke some fun at the end of that, and that would fit perfectly with Taika Waititi's tone.
Yeah.
That they would be self-referential about the Jane Foster Thor end to their relationship.
Mm-hmm. I'm good with it.
There's a Lonely Ladies Club of in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and one of those ladies has now gotten out of it. There are 2 more who are still there, and they both need to be brought back.
Liv Tyler is never coming back. It's just not going to happen, because nobody cares. That one, I can say definitively, nobody cares.
The only reason that may never happen is strictly because they recast the Hulk, and it's no longer Edward Norton. And they try their best to act like that film never happened.
Yeah.
That's why it was such a surprise that they brought back Thunderbolt Ross for Civil War.
So, I mean,
that you are now accepting that film as purely canon, outside of like the post-credit tag with Downey. Mm-hmm. Like, you were saying, now that film is canon.
Yeah, I mean, he referenced it in Avengers, like, last time I was in Harlem, I broke it, or something like that.
Right.
So they address it, but I don't think we'll get any other characters.
Yeah, you're never seeing the Abomination.
Mostly because we'll never get another Hulk movie. Right. So that's mostly why we'll never see her again.
Yeah, we won't see her. We won't see the Abomination. We won't see Dr. Brainiac or whatever is...
The leader.
The leader.
Turns into the leader. Yeah,
yeah, we won't see the leader. But, like, as far as, like, Jane Foster goes, like, if you're... This was kind of the way they were... If you're only going to be on Earth for 10 minutes, and the main purpose of you being on Earth is... A, to have Crazy Hobo Odin make everybody laugh, and B, to have Doctor Strange interact with Thor so that when they show up in Infinity War, it's not like a huge, complete shock and awe. Mm-hmm. you don't really have time for Selwig or for Kat Downing's or for Natalie Portman.
Yeah.
And if you're not going to have time for her in her solo movie, you're damn sure not going to have time for her
in
an Avengers movie. So just go ahead and cut ties and sever and just say, the long distance thing didn't work.
Yeah.
And I was ready to move on. And this is what was best for both of us. I couldn't continue hurting her like that. So I started banging Valkyrie. So, I mean, I'm okay with that.
Good. As long as you're okay with this one.
Because it makes story sense.
Yeah.
It's cathartic and it makes story sense for the character. Whereas Pepper Potts not showing up after Rhodey, you know, plummets to his near paralyzation, does not. So, all right. So that'll about do it on the Thor Ragnarok set visit. What was the most interesting thing that you learned?
Really? I guess it would be the stuff with Vatela and mostly just the fact that whatever happens on that bridge, they don't want us to know. And I'm intrigued for the fact that they've withheld Kate Blanchett's interview for now. So I didn't learn a whole lot, but, you know, it's always fun to see these things.
Yeah, it's fun because it's the most information you really get on a Marvel movie is on set visit. Yeah. So, before we go, box office records were broken this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I highly recommend to all of you listening to go to see it, except for my friend Chad here, who would be scared shitless.
Never gonna happen.
Never gonna happen.
Never.
Beautiful movie. If you combine, like, Stephen King's, like, Stand By Me with, like, Stephen King's Rose Red TV series, like, that's what you get. You get the best of the horror elements, the trippy, you know, crazy clown elements of what King does, and the coming of age, adolescent, you know, tale that King is really good at in Stand By Me and in other places in his library. And so when those two meet, and, you know, they did win a different way than Fukunawa, who has a writing credit, a screenplay by credit on this movie. But his script is out there. If you want to go and find it, it is a different take.
Okay.
This works. And I think one of the major reasons that this works is because of a thing we're getting in a few weeks called Stranger Things Season 2. I think people were ready for this kind of... The setup is the same. You have one of the same actors in the movie. The setup is the same. Outsider kids know something's up. They're trying to band together to fight an other or an entity. And so it kind of has that same feel. The humor is the same. The wit and witticisms are the same. The pacing is sort of the same. So it feels very much like a Stranger Things type situation that kind of harkens back and makes you have the feel goods and kind of gives you some perspective on it, which helps. First thing I thought of was not Stranger Things. It was Stand By Me because of the Stephen King connection. Terrific. You will fall in love with those kids. All those kids were pitch perfect, which is going to make casting the adult versions really, really hard. The other thing that I would say is some of the more brutal parts of the book are left out. Some of the more controversial parts of the book are left out.
I know what that is.
Yeah. Although the child molestation part is in there and very heavily hinted at. Like, maybe not explicitly said, but, like, yeah. And I love the fact that they give the town the feel that it deserves. Every one of the adults is a very messed up person. And, like, you feel bad for these kids who are forced to grow up in this hellhole with a lot of pervy, creepy, rude, bad adults. And, you know, it's a really enjoyable film that breezes along. It never feels long. The scares are okay. You know, Pennywise is done beautifully. The Skarsgård does a tremendous job with the performance, taking it in a completely different direction than Tim Curry. The exposition is done just well enough that it doesn't feel like they're beating you over the head with it. They leave just enough breadcrumbs for you to be interested in a sequel. And the fact that they conceived this when he was on board as a two-part movie and they kept that structure really works here. And I am glad to see it making all of this money.
Yeah, lots of money.
Lots of money. Like the second highest grossing R-rated movie behind Deadpool. Nice. For an opening. The largest R-rated horror movie opening ever. Like the largest Stephen King opening ever. I mean, this is like bordering on Jurassic World like projections being wrong. Because, like, the projections were from 60 to 70.
Yeah.
Things gonna top out at maybe 125. 117 on the low end. So that is way outpacing.
I think we're past 117. I think 123 is, like, the low end now.
Yeah, 123, 125, which is amazing.
Yeah.
And something that the box office clearly needed. And that's one thing that I think also aided this movie. They marketed it really well to mainstream audiences who did not even know Stephen King. The clown... Pennywise has been in the subconscious of the world of pop culture for 20 years, so that's helped. And then, of course, the fact that you had a whole bunch of garbage, including another garbage Stephen King adaptation in August, people were starved for an opportunity and for a reason to go back to the theater, and they got that this week. So I think all those factors combined led to a tremendous box office success that has the potential to have great legs, because I'm sorry... But Aronofsky is a very niche film director, and I don't care if he does have Jennifer Lawrence as his lead, that film's not going to get the horror play that it is going to.
Nope.
The mainstream audiences will go to see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw all of that, so that's a good thing. I will never see the movie, but I'm glad to hear that.
You could. It's a mild-mannered horror movie. It is not a bloody movie by any stretch. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, there's that one scene.
But... Yeah, I know about that scene too. No, yeah. Never happened. It's not going to happen.
Not going to happen. Okay. So that'll about do it for this week's podcast. If you want to keep up with us on Twitter, you can follow me at BCW Tiger Fan.
At The Mets Theory.
And it is the Movies on the Brain podcast. You can find us on iTunes, like us, give us feedback, and download us and let us know what we can do better. All right. And for those of you attending Comic-Con Lafayette, Comic-Con Louisiana, I will not be able to attend this year, so we will miss that show. All right. Thank you very much, and have a pleasant evening.